Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Central Ohio artist Derek Gill traveled the world and returned with the sounds of the world. Now he's sharing those sound memories with the rest of us. Let's listen to a few examples. These are steel guitars mixed with human chatter and street noises in Rome's Orange Garden, which dates to the 10th century. That's not the sound I was shooting for. We'll get to those in just a second. In the meantime, Gill, sound as art, in the case of Gill's work, is part of a trend of artists embracing artificial intelligence, virtual reality, robots, and other technologies to alter the dimensions of their work. He splits his time between his Columbus studio and New York, and he's created a robotic series titled Living Machines, an aspect of which is on display at COSAI through November. It's called The Memory Machine. Sound, which includes the sounds we will hear in just a minute. Welcome to the show, Derek Gill.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So let's see. Can we tee up one of those sounds? Nope, not yet. Okay. Anyways, all right. We'll wait with bated breath to hear the sounds. But Derek, an increasing number of artists are embracing artificial intelligence, virtual reality, robotics, and other technologies. How do you use the technology in your work? What's going to be different? What are we going to hear that is art?
Yeah, I think art in general is one of those things that you take the world around you as an artist and you try to digest it and then give it back to the people to look at, to hear, to experience. And this is different than general robotics where it's task-based, or maybe you're just trying to perform something on repeat over and over. This, in my work, I try to use the nuances of how we as humans interact with each other. Maybe this is, in this case, recalling and compartmentalizing memories, sounds, experiences, and then just being able to give that back as a thinking process rather than just a tactical job maneuvering. So, for example, a regular robotics piece that you'd see in a factory is just performing a task to help industry. This is to promote thinking and energy back into the world so that other people can kind of experience it on their own terms.
Okay, so let's hear the steel guitars mixed with human chatter and street noises in Rome's Orange Garden, which dates to the 10th century. Okay, so how did you, where's the technology part of that besides just the actual recording?
Okay, sure. There's several components. So I take a field recorder with me, usually anywhere I go. And I was traveling in Rome, as you know. And anytime there's an experience that I feel is particularly potent, I'll take that field recorder out and take a small snippet of sound. Bringing it back into the studio, I take that little, you know, snippet of sound and I program a little microcontroller to replay that sound when a particular action is done. In this particular piece, there's a motion sensor that is triggered when you walk by and it selects at random from an SD card that's on a little microcontroller. It selects maybe one of 50, 100, depending on which piece. Sounds, and then it'll play back. And then, of course, it's over speakers, it's over kind of a light system. In the piece at COSAI, it's in a set of wooden tubes. The electronics are housed in three different wooden tubes, and it's suspended from the ceiling about 14 feet, I think. And so people will walk underneath it, and the sound plays in stereo from 14, 15 feet in left and right. So just like if you were there in real life, if a car drives by, you'll hear it go from left to right, and this sound is in three dimensions.
So what we just heard, all right, I heard the steel guitar, I heard the human chatter, I heard insects?
Yeah, oh, the cicadas and other bugs. These are those special moments that, you know, you really hope for when you're taking field recordings. This captures a particular moment in time. And, you know, I was able to witness it visually, but to kind of separate and compartmentalize the visuals from the sounds, you can actually see, if you want, quote, you can actually see different things just by listening instead of having, you know, visuals also. And one of those things that, of course, I listened to this recording hundreds of times to edit it and to make sure that I get the fade right. And each time I listen to it, I hear more and more things. There's a little stroller that's walking by, and that recalls the memory that I had walking by. It reminds me of what I was looking at in real time. And if I could share that with the world, that makes everything much better.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking with Derek Gill. He's a Central Ohio interdisciplinary artist. He specializes in paintings and robotic sculpture, but he has also created a robotic series titled Living Machines, an aspect of which is on display at COSAI through November. It's called The Memory Machine Sound. It includes the sounds we just heard. Here is the sound from the gathering spot at the Eiffel Tower in, of course, Paris. Yeah, I love hearing. I was worried it was going to be American speaking, some kind of, but it's very French.
Yeah, I think there's a moment where we've all seen a picture of the Eiffel Tower. We all know what that kind of looks like, but to listen to it gives a tone that is quite different than just the static imagery. You know, as a visual artist, we're so used to playing with the visuals, but there's something so potent and enriching about sitting there on a blanket underneath the Eiffel Tower and just watching people go by. And there's like another guitar playing in the background. There's at one point in this, it's several minute long sample, there's a guy who tries to sell us a bottle of wine, but there's something very human to it, to hear the organic influx of volume as the crowd gets a little louder and then hushes. It's just something so intangible that taking a recording and bringing it back to other people just really drives a little bit of experience there.
How did you tap into this? When did this become a thing for you, the sound part?
Oh, that's a great question. I've been making the Living Machines for almost 10 years now. And I had a piece at the Columbus Museum of Art last, I guess, 2021 and 2022 that was a very complicated piece. And it had a sound component, but it was also built during COVID. And one of the biggest missing components was I couldn't go anywhere to get sounds for this particular robot. And there was just this organic, natural progression of, well, if I can't go anywhere now, as soon as I can go somewhere, I'm just going to go everywhere. And I missed those intangible moments of travel. I think everyone has that thing that they really missed during lockdown. Some people really missed concerts. Other people really missed, you know, their family. Of course, I missed my family, but I also missed having unique experiences. Doing that same thing every day just really was hard for me.
Yeah.
So I just stumbled on really missing those unique experiences. And, you know, there's hiking in the mountains in the Swiss Alps that I just didn't get to do for a couple years. Now, that sounds very privileged, but I live a very modest life so that I can do those things. And I truly miss those. So if I could make an excuse to do that, then I certainly would do that.
And I would too. Your COSAI exhibit is titled The Memory Machine Sound, and it features sounds from your travels around the world, which is what you're talking about. And here's one from some rainfall in an alpine, alpine in Switzerland. Let's listen. Wow, you could that goes on for a lot longer, I hope.
Yeah, actually, that storm lasted probably an hour, and I have the full recording. Now, the public only gets to hear maybe 14 minutes in several different samples, but Yeah, I could play that and fall asleep. And I do. But yeah, I was in the Swiss Alps and a nice little chalet. I think that one's in Grindelwald. And it was kind of in the middle of the night. And earlier that day, the mountains were just beautiful. And there was this orange cast as the sun set next to the mountains. And I could see a rainstorm coming in. And of course, I pulled out my recorder and I was like, I can't wait. And as it came in, like I said, this sound plays in stereo. So you can hear over the duration of the hour-long sample, you can hear the storm come from miles away, get closer, be right on top of you, and then go away. And there's some visceral component about hearing distance that I'm very attracted to. Just hearing distance is something that, you know, we take for granted a lot of times.
How has delving into this aspect of life, the sound of life, how has it changed you as an artist? Because you specialize in painting and sculpture.
Yeah, so that's a great question. There's a part of painting that you can't tap into, which is active nature of painting. It's a document that's finished as soon as you're done painting and it dries and you frame it and you put it on the wall. The entire conversation that you as an artist have developed, that is on display, and it doesn't have any change to it.
It's static.
There's no dynamic nature to it at all. Building robotic pieces allows me a dynamic component, and the sound is only one aspect. Another reason why I was interested in the sound aspect was even when I was developing the sculptures that have light, for example, people have a myriad of abilities. Some people can't see that light, and this medium allows me to tap into a person who can witness my work that may not be able to see the lights that are playing in other pieces or the painting.
You know, the other day I was watching a plein air artist, outdoors, obviously, painting, and I watched them from, I don't think they knew I was watching. I was watching them from across a parking lot. They were actually in a parking lot painting an old building in Worthington. And I did think about how they're sitting out there with all this sound and the sunlight, and it was a warm day and there were birds and cars driving by, and their experience of painting it had to be very different than what anyone else would eventually see.
So I was hoping you would say something like that, right? I could tell you that is a meaningful moment that you might miss as a two-dimensional viewer. But I want people to listen to my explanation of work and then give me back exactly that feedback. Is, oh, you know what? I just came up with this idea I never thought of. I'm missing out on another aspect. And so thank you. That's exactly what I want someone to get from.
Do you travel places for sound? Like, especially for particular sound? Like, I guess a train, railroad track, hypothetically, to be super literal.
No, I wouldn't say that I specifically seek out things in advance. But I can say that now, doing this for a while, once I have a selected point, I kind of try to figure out what I might listen to. Like after I exist in a space, I'll go, you know what? I'm going to this very famous relic. What does this famous relic sound like there? And I have a recording of a historic sculpture that's in Berlin. And it would be strange to try to describe to someone at the very beginning, I'm going to go and listen to a sculpture, a bust of Nefertiti, for example. Well, you don't have any idea what that might sound like. You have no expectation of what that might sound like. But once you're there, you're surprised. You can hear jingles of keys from the security guard that's walking by. I think the best example of this is the Sistine Chapel. Everyone has seen a picture or has been to the Sistine Chapel. One hugely surprising thing was how, one, loud it is in that room, and two, there's no photography allowed, and I'm sure no recordings are allowed either. So there's a little under the radar there. But every like 2 minutes, there's someone who just yells over a PA system, no photography, no, please move, keep the crowd moving. And I mean, why would you ever think one of the world's most famous, beautiful ceilings has just this yelling person just completely condemning phones, you know? I can't explain that in a painting. Maybe I could. Yeah, I could do that. But it just says something slightly different.
Right.
In sound.
Well, I'm really looking forward to the COSAI exhibit, checking it out. I've got some time coming up. Derek Gill is a Central Ohio interdisciplinary artist specializing in painting and robotics sculpture. And he has created a robotic series titled Living Machines, an aspect of which is on display at COSAI through November. It's called The Memory Machine Sound, and it includes the sounds we've heard during the program. Derek Gill, best wishes for every success.
You.
Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, no, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
You bet. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up. Yes, it is Tech Tuesday today. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Supreme Court last week ruled that the families of terrorism victims had not proved that Google, Twitter, and Facebook helped foster attacks on their loved ones. The court last week handed the tech industry another victory by declining to weigh in on a protective internet law known as Section 230 at the center of the debate over social media regulation. Joining us in a very special event, in person, to talk about this and everything else tech-related is Russell Holley, Managing Editor of Commerce at CNET. He just surprised me. He drove in from Baltimore yesterday and surprised me today with this visit. Thank you so much.
My phone wasn't working, so I couldn't call in like normal. It just seemed like the most reasonable.
Oh my gosh, this is so awesome. I mean, we set aside a couple segments to talk because it's our last Tech Tuesday together. You've been with me from the beginning of Tech Tuesday.
It's been a while.
I think you were there on the very first show.
Is that right?
I think so.
Now,
not the very first one, it was the second one. I mean, it was right up there.
Yeah.
And you just stuck with me. How many jobs have you had since?
I don't know, like three or four.
But you always made sure you got a job.
This was a part of my contract, being able to do, like, quite literally for my job with CNET. One of the things that that I did, I said under no uncertain circumstances would I give this up.
Oh,
I was talking to you every Tuesday.
Well, it's been a number one. So relaxing to know that no matter what I throw at you, you'll come back with something.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk for just a minute about the Supreme Court ruling. Some people were hoping they'd give them an opportunity to rein in tech. This did the exact opposite. What are the implications of upholding Section 230?
Yeah, so Section 230 refers to a thing called the Communications Decency Act. And one of the thing that makes Section 230 important is it basically says that companies are not responsible for what other people put on their platforms. So if someone comes on Twitter and says, I'm going to come to your house and do something violent to you, Twitter is not responsible for that that thing that has been said. The Communications Decency Act says that you know, the person who said that is the group that's responsible and not the company. Now, there's been a lot of conversation surrounding Section 230 over the last couple of years because it is believed that Facebook and Twitter uses Section 230 as a way to censor certain voices. You know, Republicans like to say that it's Republican voices. Democrats like to say that it's liberal voices. But the end result is that these companies make decisions based on advertising. You know, if it benefits their advertisers to have certain kinds of content on, then they keep it on there. And if not, then they remove it. And so, you know, over the last couple of years, we've seen this trend of a ton of different online groups going to advertisers and saying, hey, are you actually OK with this kind of content being right next to your ad? You know, be it, you know, hate speech or, you know, calls for violence or something like that, regardless of the context. And it turns out that most advertisers are not super cool with that. That they would really prefer that their ads be next to like pictures of puppies, mm-hmm. and things like that. So Twitter and Facebook and all of these other platforms, they moderate based on, you know, what they think their advertisers would like to put their stuff next to, and that's basically as simple as it gets. The Supreme Court cases were about, you know, two different cases in which acts of violence or the promise of violence led to actual violence against human beings. There are several people who died. And the argument that was made was that Twitter and Google, in two separate cases, were responsible for the deaths of these people because they allowed this content on their platform. In one case, it was posts on Twitter from ISIS. And in Google's case, it was something that was not quite as centrally listed. And the Supreme Court basically said, we're not going to rule on this as a ruling on Section 230. We're just going to say that Google and Twitter were not liable for those actions. And we're going to make it so that Congress has to decide how Section 230 gets changed or, you know, kind of abbreviated.
And since Congress has not often taken up the reins of dealing with tech and tech regulation, the likelihood of that is...
It's really low, and a lot of it comes from just sort of core competencies. You know, this is our lawmakers overwhelmingly struggle when it comes to tech, both in understanding how it works and being able to kind of legislate around it. There is a now quite famous video of Mark Zuckerberg kind of smirking during his last congressional hearing because one of the senators asked him how it was that Facebook made money. When it wasn't something that was sold, because the advertising model was something that was just kind of foreign to that senator. And that level of understanding is something that a lot of these tech companies are very happy to take advantage of.
Hmm. You know, the protections in Section 230, they're pretty central to free speech going forward too, though, right?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, the idea, you know, if Section 230 did not exist today and Google and Facebook and Twitter were the liable party when it came to any content that was put on their platforms, very little other than pictures of cats and dogs would be on there. You know, if someone has a political opinion that is any spicier than I don't think this is a good idea, then it's very easy for another group to say, hey, I think I'm going to file a lawsuit against Google for this thing that is on their platform, regardless of, you know, how benign that thing may be. That could tie up, you know, these companies in legal battles kind of for eternity.
What was your sense about the acumen of the Supreme Court in this ruling when it comes to tech and the implications of all of this?
I think it is a good thing that this group of people decided that this was not something that was in kind of their area of expertise and decided that they would make this ruling based on, you know, kind of the merits of the case and not necessarily an interpretation of the law surrounding it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that has created a window that reinforces for the moment that Google and Facebook and Twitter and a lot of these other companies, especially with the conversation surrounding whether TikTok should be allowed in a bunch of different places, you know, that moderation is now pretty firmly until something happens to Section 230. You know, the there is not going to be, you know, some grand effort to adjust how that moderation is happening.
You know, now we're, you know, 10 years ago, we were talking about tech in one way, and now a lot of what we've talked about in recent months has to do with artificial intelligence. I mean, it really is on that springboard now. We hear it in advertising. People know what it is. And I'm just wondering, I mean, and yet as a nation, you know, our governing bodies are still struggling with what their role is in regulating it.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true. And, you know, a lot of it is, you know, a surprise to no one, incredibly financially motivated. You know, being able to have these AI things, you know, whether it is replacing a potential person on a workforce, or, you know, kind of trying to create art from, you know, from seemingly nothing, you know, all of these efforts are, if you kind of follow those threads, they ultimately come down to these companies doing things that are to their financial benefit and not necessarily for the greater good, for a lot of these cases. And we're going to quickly see a kind of bifurcation in this technology where it's groups of people who are trying to do things that, you know, kind of improve the quality of humanity, and kind of our day-to-day lives, versus people who are trying to make something as inexpensive as possible in order to sell it for the same price. And that is going to be a thing that is going to have to be pretty heavily contested over the next couple of years.
You know, speaking of TikTok, Montana, I think, just voted to ban TikTok.
And TikTok matched by filing a lawsuit against them.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I mean, for one thing, forget the lawsuit, which I fully expected, but how would they control that?
So there's a really interesting set of statistics that have been done now, some math that got done very shortly after this law passed. It is more financially viable for Google and Apple to pay the fines that Montana has set up for having TikTok on the App Store. It costs them less money to pay those fines than it would be to fight Montana on this. And it's like a rounding error for these companies. It ends up being something like $2 million a year that they would end up paying to the state of Montana. Montana, who would end up spending more than that $2 million to enforce it within, you know, kind of the boundaries of their own state. So, yeah, it's, you know, enforcement is going to be next to impossible. And it is not helped by the fact that Google and Apple are not in any real way motivated to help enforce it. So I don't know that law is actually going to accomplish anything.
Do you know what the basis of the TikTok lawsuit is?
The basis of the TikTok lawsuit.
Is it interstate commerce or something
like
that?
Okay. Yeah. So it's essentially, you know, that this is not something that that, you know, meets the rigor of something that could be banned across the state. And that is unlikely to be something that resolves itself anytime soon. But again, in the meantime, if it's not being enforced, it kind of doesn't matter.
And if they have, okay, so they want them to take TikTok off the app stores. I've already got TikTok on my phone. So I'm driving through Montana.
Oh, nothing changes.
Nothing changes. Right. All right. And so you could just, I mean.
Right. There is no like rhyme or reason to it. At the end of the day, if Apple and Google wanted to pull TikTok from the App Store just when you are in the state of Montana, which they're not going to do.
Could they, though?
They could.
Okay.
You know, there are ways, you know, with you know, the help of your carrier to kind of have a rough idea of where you are. Not
okay,
your exact
gotcha.
Location, but, you know, kind of your general location. So when you cross those state lines, you know, when I arrived here in Ohio, a lot of the advertisements in my Facebook feed, for example, were telling me about wonderful things that were happening here in the area because, you know, I hadn't told anybody on my phone that I was that I was here in Ohio. I hadn't posted on social media or anything, mostly out of fear that you would see it. But I was immediately greeted with that information. That same kind of technology would be used to make sure that if you were in that area, that TikTok would not be available in the App Store. But building that is not something that doesn't currently exist within those stores. There isn't like a United States state by state, you know, kind of listing for those applications. There are country by country, limitations for those kind of things. But building it state by state is something that would cost these companies money. And there's not really a lot of motivation to build it right now. So,
yeah. And just one more question about the Montana law. Would it criminalize users of TikTok, like people?
That's a good question. And I'm not 100% on that. I know that there is some language in there for creating TikToks within Montana in a way that you can like demonstrate that it was done in Montana. But it's again, a situation that is incredibly difficult to enforce, short of standing in front of a monument in Montana and recording something, it would be kind of difficult to prove, especially with things like virtual backgrounds and stuff like that.
Wow. Okay. There's more to talk about. My guest right here in the studio, in person, in the flesh, Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. We'll be right back. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Over the years of doing Tech Tuesday, we have covered a lot of trends, some of which continue to be central to the industry. Others have faded away. Still with us is Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, who is visiting me in person, I guess, to celebrate my retirement. This is our last Tech Tuesday together.
So it's funny. I think I've actually been threatening to come here to the studio for about 7 years.
Yeah.
And I just hadn't done it. And so when I heard that you were retiring, I was like, well, now it has to. Like, there's not a
busy guy,
places.
But man, yeah. I really appreciate it. I'm very excited, everybody out there. So, I hope you share in the excitement. Have Russell Holley right here in Columbus, Ohio, even as we speak. All right. There's some new smart devices last week out of Amazon, and it has to do with Alexa.
Yeah. So Amazon, there was a whole bunch of news last year that Amazon had hemorrhaged just an enormous amount of money with Alexa. And it was kind of widely expected that there would be kind of a pulling back on this particular platform because it had been so expensive and it wasn't something that had made Amazon the amount of money that it had originally thought when creating this program. But after last week's announcement, it really kind of feels like Amazon has just kind of accepted that the Alexa program is just kind of too big to fail. And so they keep releasing things for it. And what we saw this past week was a set of new speakers with a new design, as well as a new set of earbuds and really kind of continuing this trend. Amazon really wants Alexa to kind of be everywhere that you are so that you're not just using it at home by having it in your car and in your headphones and you know, kind of attached to all of these other things.
These are $50 Echo Buds.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah, not bad at all.
If they're any good.
Well, so the last version that they released of these were really great for the price that they were, and they kind of offered the what are called true wireless headphones. So there's not like a band that goes around the back of your head or you know, kind of a cable that you have to worry about. You put them in a battery case in order to charge them when you're not using them. But they're very kind of plain looking. You know, they're really kind of standard flat black, you know, clear pieces of plastic that go in your ear, and for as inexpensive as they are, they actually sound quite nice.
And then the devices with screens, they're becoming more popular.
They are becoming more popular, and part of me wonders if it's just because the platform kind of bullies you to use it every day. I have one set up in my kitchen that regularly, you know, asks me to. To take a look at recipes or to take a look at orders that I have made. And in some cases, it's pretty helpful for, you know, a little chime that'll come up and say, hey, it's been 3 months since you've ordered protein shakes. Do you want to grab more of those? And I go, hey, I'm actually running low on those. Like, that's
wow.
Not a bad idea. So in some cases, it can be quite useful. But in other cases, it really wants me to ask it to tell me a knock-knock joke. and I'm just not overly interested in that particular relationship with the robot in my kitchen. So,
like I said, we've been talking a lot about AI lately. I mean, do you just ever wonder if someday Alexa's gonna open up?
Well, so that was its original promise. You know, Amazon wanted this to be a thing that eventually led to people doing most of their shopping using their voice. Like, that was at its core what that was supposed to be. And, you know, some of that started very early on in the form of being able to maintain a grocery list on your Alexa, which we did a segment on very long when my kids were young and would do things like, you know, giggle at themselves as they requested toilet paper 100 times on the grocery list and, you know, did silly things like that. But it never really turned into the kind of one-stop shopping experience that Amazon wanted it to be. So it became this entertainment product instead, where you could stream music and you could, you know, kind of have a little television that lived in your kitchen. And now they sell 15-inch screens that have family calendars built into them and, you know, kind of big to-do lists that everyone in the house can interact with. And it kind of turned from this shopping experience to this kind of home management system, especially if you had like a smart home.
It's interesting how Amazon was willing and able to flex with Alexa and how people preferred to use it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we don't think about it a lot, but a really similar version of that is Apple Watch. You know, Apple released that as a thing that was supposed to be, if for some people, a replacement to your phone when you weren't when you were out doing something. You could leave your phone somewhere and have everything happen on your wrist. And it turned out that a lot of people just did not want to use apps on their watch like that. And the fitness tracking thing didn't really strike well because it was very expensive for those watches, and you could get a Fitbit for $20. So mm-hmm. So why would I do that? So Apple leaned in really hard to the health stuff. You know, fall detection and accident detection and the heart rate monitor and the oxygen sensor and the sleep detection to make it this kind of whole body thing instead. And it's worked really well, you know, to even though it ends up being frequently more expensive than a lot of its competitors.
You know, the reason why I like it is because since I got on the radio, I turned off my sound on my phone, which drives my spouse and my son crazy because I never answer my phone. But now it's like my Dick Tracy watch.
Yeah.
You know, it tells me when somebody's calling. And it's asking me what I want, and I don't want anything from my watch because it knows I'm talking about
That's
it.
That's right.
It's so creepy. I'm serious. It's so creepy. Do you expect Alexa is someday going to be her?
No, I don't think it'll quite get that advanced. Every time there is a step forward in a lot of these AI systems kind of doing things for you, it involves taking a look at your personal information. And we still haven't really finished the privacy conversation yet when it comes to a lot of this technology. In some cases, it'll end up being, you know, pretty positive. But if you take a look at the way that Apple has approached what it does with Siri, it's just never really held up in terms of what it's capable of, even when it comes to doing things like answering simple math problems. So adding AI to that will certainly make some of that easier. But at some point, there has to be a decision between, you know, whether you're giving these companies all of your data or not in order for this stuff to be useful.
I know it's a learning, they're learning programs. So the more you talk to them, the better they get, right?
That's the theory. There are definitely cases where that is true. Google has done a bunch of really interesting stuff with its kind of voice tracking stuff, as well as its facial recognition stuff. You know, your phone, unlocks based on this really kind of clear picture of your face. But if you do things like, if I take my glasses off and I put contacts in, my phone has no idea who I am. Like, my iPhone just doesn't know. And that's something that has set Google and Apple apart, is that Google is constantly updating that picture of you.
Mm-hmm.
and referencing
all the iterations
of
you. Yeah.
So, you know, it's able to make these kind of points of contrast, which is probably great as long as you don't have like a secret twin that really wants the information on your phone. That kind of thing, you know, it's going to be a really gradual process. Otherwise, it's going to freak people out.
You wanted to talk about The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom, and it's funny because I had a guy in that I do to talk about children's learning and tech, and he loves The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom.
Oh, yeah.
He said it's just one of the best things ever.
This is secretly one of the most advanced physics engines that have ever been created.
How so?
In that, you know, there's kind of a set of physics that exists across this game, and it allows you to build things on a level that feels kind of like Minecraft, but like wildly more advanced. And YouTube and TikTok and all of these places are now, like, the game hasn't been out one full week yet,
right.
And there are now hundreds of hours of videos of people assembling using sticks and like magic pieces and stuff throughout this game, building robots and advanced flying machines and, you know, very complex engines and things like that, through no set of instruction in the game, just entirely based on the pieces that are available. These at-home engineers have just, you know, absolutely turned this game on its head. And it's entirely because all of the different pieces that they have put in this game have these rules that are not governed by like a single use. Like they built this thing and they said, okay, do with this what you will. And it has turned into this thing where we will probably be a year from now where people have played this game for hundreds of hours and not finished it entirely because they're interested in the creative process and kind of building more complex machines and not actually because of the next mission in the game.
Interesting. I mean, is there any other game like it?
Minecraft is the closest, you know, kind of current example.
Where you build your universe.
Yeah, where you're kind of building the universe and there's a lot of, kind of mechanized things that can be used in it. Kind of a less direct version of it is a game called Kerbal Space Program, where the entire goal is to use very simple machines to build a rocket ship that goes up, and you're kind of constantly iterating in order to do that. That's a more limited version of this, in that it's kind of physics with the specific goal of getting your rocket off of the platform. But yeah, there have been versions of this that have existed, but they're usually kind of purpose made. Minecraft was made for you to be able to build your own world. You know, Kerbal Space Program was built, you know, for that purpose. This is supposed to be a Zelda game where you walk around with a guy in a funny green hat and a sword and a shield, and you punch things until you win. Like that's what Zelda is. But underneath of that, you know, kind of punching and slicing simulator, you now have this really advanced physics engine that is super fascinating.
And that's what the teacher was so excited
Absolutely.
About, because kids love this. This is what it was meant to be when you talk about video games for kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is 100%, you know, the sandbox doesn't really have limitations. When it comes to this kind of thing, there are pieces all around for you to kind of build whatever you want. There's not necessarily a right or wrong answer to solve all of the different puzzles that are throughout the game. And it really, you know, for anyone who wants to teach a kid the basics of engineering, like this is a really great way to do it.
You know, I'm wondering what you thought about, you know, when we first started talking and where we're now, where we are a decade later when it comes to video games. And you know, what your expectations were and what the current, the current era suggests you going forward.
I really think that the next step for a lot of these games, and it's something that these companies have been trying for more than a decade now, and they kind of backed off a little bit a couple years ago, but I think they're going to try again here within the next 10 years, is to kind of move away from the controller as we know it. The kind of standard thing has been there for a while, and it changes in little bits every once in a while. It becomes more responsive, and, you know, kind of there's a few more buttons, but its function hasn't really changed in a meaningful way in a while. And I think that that's kind of the next step, is building something where either your hands are being used in a more, you know, kind of dynamic fashion. Maybe there's a camera that's keeping an eye on what your fingers are doing, or, some extra sensory things. If you look at VR controllers, there's a lot of really interesting tech there about sensors that know where your fingers are without having to push a button down, being able to kind of grip and release without actually having to do something. And I think that we'll see that kind of technology get used, less about, how many buttons we can shove on this thing, but how, you know, kind of naturally you can use your hands in order to be a part of the game.
You know, I was thinking when I was rewatching Avatar recently, that how they kind of look down on that table and they can see everything.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, it's not virtual reality. It's sort of...
like hologram.
Yeah, hologram. Do you see a future in that kind of an aspect?
There have been several companies over the last couple of years that have been trying to do a lot of clever things with holograms, either through dust particles and light or, through kind of contained spaces. There's some really fascinating like depth perception trick stuff through video chats that Google's been trying to do for making it so that you're video chatting with someone, but they physically feel like they're right in front of you because it's using, depth perception tricks. And I think that that's something that's going to continue to grow and expand, but it's really complicated to get stuff like that inside of everyone's house because everyone's space is different. And at some point, it would have to be a really significant break in technology in order for that to be something that could just live on a kitchen table.
3D printing, we used to talk about that a lot.
Yeah.
And now I get to see your little 3D printer in the background when I talk
working.
To you. You're always building something.
Yep.
In March, a rocket made almost entirely of 3D printed materials made its launch debut and then fizzled. Most households don't have 3D printers. You brought me a gift today.
I did.
I'm so excited. Tell us
this
what it
is. This is super cool. So the box that you're holding was actually printed in one piece. There weren't multiple pieces that came together to form this thing. This printed as a single object, and it is a box that has a spring-loaded lid. This is a free file that was available on Thingiverse that could be printed using some really pretty filament that I found that's a nice like purple and blue.
Oh, yeah, it's awesome.
But the goal is this kind of one-piece thing, and you can imagine like larger versions of this where industrial printers could make this for kind of storage solutions. And that's really the thing. You know, 3D printing is not going to be a thing that lives in everyone's home for a while because it's just very the learning curve for adjusting to that kind of stuff is really fascinating. But on a business level, I see it in new and really interesting applications all the time. There is a really lovely construction company that is a part of, you know, kind of Maryland Reliable Contracting, and their fleet of vehicles, they have a 3D printer inside their workshop for industrial stuff, and it's a carbon fiber printer. Instead of using plastic like you're using, it's actually printing out carbon fiber, and they use it to replace parts on their fleet of vehicles. Instead of waiting for official parts to come in, which can take weeks, in the meantime, they can print a new part just entirely made of carbon fiber and attach it and get that vehicle back out. You see 3D printing constantly used in prototyping for cars now, where there'll be hundreds of different iterations that can be made over the span of days, whereas originally, cars were made using kind of clay and different mediums to kind of create the look and feel. They can now be printed in hours. Microsoft has a really crazy fabrication setup on their campus where a lot of the kind of hardware engineers will build something during the day using software. And at night, there's an entire team of people that print whatever that idea was so that engineer has it on their desk in the morning in order to kind of work on the next iteration of it. All of those different things have improved so much over the last 10 years that it makes it really easy and inexpensive to like constantly iterate on a thing that you would want to make for other people to have.
My spouse wants me to ask you what kind of computer I should get. I need my own PC now because I'm not going to have a company issued.
Oh, gosh. That's a really good one.
Remember, we used to talk about that stuff all the time.
We did used to talk about that stuff all the time. You probably want to get like a decent like Dell XPS that wouldn't be too expensive, but it'll stick around with you for a while.
Okay.
That's probably the way that I would go.
Because I'll mostly just use it for writing.
Yeah, yeah. So like a standard like XPS 15, because it wouldn't be too big. You'd be able to take it to a coffee shop and just kind of chill out.
Okay. All right. And he said it's cool that you're on the show with me today in the studio.
I agree.
He's very religious, Russell Holly follower. He said you make me sound smart.
You definitely sound plenty smart on your own.
No. We have 1 minute left. And I wanted to ask you, I bought a new pair of sunglasses a couple weeks ago. Prescription, so I had to go, to the store, and they're showing all those glasses with the cameras on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like Snapchat spectacles.
Yeah.
And,
are people picking this up and buying it? Okay.
No, definitely not. They're certainly gotten visually more appealing, from the days of Google Glass looking kind of awkward, sticking out of a set of glasses.
Yeah, you can't really tell.
No, they've gotten much better. And they're, from a privacy perspective, they're a little more limited. You can see kind of lights around the lenses when they're recording or taking a picture or something, but it's still incredibly limited. It's not something that provides any active feedback to the person. You take a picture and then you have to pull out your phone in order to look at the picture. It kind of defeats the purpose. Your phone happens to have one of those lovely cameras on it. The cameras on those glasses are never going to be as nice as the camera on your phone. It's just, physics gets in the way. And likewise, battery life, on any of those things, anytime, the idea of having glasses completely replace your phone is, very science fiction. And it's very cool. And I would love something like that. But we're just nowhere near that being reality.
Russell Holly, it's been a thrill. A super thrill having you in the studio with me today. Thanks so much for traveling from Baltimore to be with us.
It has been
today.
A genuine pleasure.
That is Russell Holly, managing editor for commerce at CNET. I can't remember what he used to be doing when he first started coming on the show 10 years ago when we started Tech Tuesday. Thanks to everybody who have stuck with us over the years. Tech Tuesday will endure. however, with All Sides. So keep listening. And thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.